We're broadcasting from the Middle Tennessee Electric Studios.
Visit MTE.com. MTE.com.
Middle Tennessee Electric.
Serving to make life better
since 1936.
Talking with Rutherford County newsmakers for 78 years. This is WGNS Action Line. Now, your host, Scott Walker.
Today in studio, we have Justin Stefanski from the Agriculture Extension Service. How are you this morning?
Good morning, sir. I'm doing fantastic. Beautiful spring day.
It's nice out there, isn't it?
Oh,
feels
it's fantastic.
Good. So how is everything in the world of agriculture?
It's cranking up. Yep. When that sun comes out and the birds start chirping, I tell you what, my phone starts ringing. So that's always my barometer for what's going on in Rutherford County from a horticultural perspective. So people are out in the gardens. I guarantee there's folks that have already planted tomatoes, and they've probably replanted them already. You know, it seems like our weather is always uncertain this time of year.
So what are some of the common questions you get this time of year from folks, you know, who call, who drop into the Ag Center? What do they ask?
You know, there's a lot of vegetable gardening questions. You know, people are thinking about getting their vegetable garden. Soil testing is a big one. They submit their soil test to us, and then they get the results back. And it takes a little interpretive skills to look at that soil test result to know what they're looking at. So I help people interpret those results, but also just trees and shrubs and flowers, looking for recommendations. I'll tell you what, native plants and landscaping with our natives has become massively popular. I just taught a native plant course and a cedar glade appreciation course and had 30 people sign up in a matter of days. I mean, it's just one of those things that's the movement is growing every year. It's very encouraging.
You know, I was reading about kale recently. You know, the weird things we choose to read when we're bored, you know, search the internet for everything. But anyway, I was reading about kale, and it was talking about the metal content within kale, and I never heard that before. But why would that be?
It's probably just that it pulls it out of the soil.
Okay.
You know, certain plants are really good at uptake of those minerals in the soil, so iron, potassium, things like that. And kale is a big leafy green vegetable, so you think it's got a lot of surface area. And it's very stout. You know, those veins on a kale plant are pretty robust. So, you know, the amount of nutrients and metals that it's able to pull out of the soil is probably a lot higher than some plants.
Now, do we have a lot of metals in our soil here? Do some areas have more?
I don't think we have any more than any other place on, you know, in the southeast. You know, now there are certain spots, I'm sure, that the concentration could be higher in pockets if there was industrial usage there. But for the most part, our soils are pretty baseline normal compared to everybody else.
Well, that's good to hear we're normal.
Yes, it's good to be normal.
That's right. Now, rock, we obviously do have a lot of rock in our soil.
Lots and lots of rock, absolutely.
Do different types of rock cause different, I don't know, problems or situations for those growing plants?
You know, it doesn't. The only issue is soil depth. You know, it's not so much, you know, the predominant rock here is limestone. And limestone itself doesn't cause problems for the plants. It's just soil depth is the issue. And when you don't have it, plants struggle. And that's where these native plants are so well adapted to grow in those harsh conditions. You think about a cedar glade, sometimes the soil is only mere inches or less. And these plants are perfectly adapted to growing it. They've naturally evolved in those environments. But a lot of these plants that we still use in our landscapes, you know, they're imported from China, from Southeast Asia, and they grow on mountain slopes in Japan. They are not suited for growing in Middle Tennessee with less than a foot of soil. So the root rot is one of the biggest problems that I see here across the board.
Yeah, you know, you go to Cedars of Lebanon and you start hiking through their trails and everything, you'll see cedars growing on rock.
On top
like,
of rock.
How'd that happen?
And it's really incredible. You know, the cedar tree is so maligned, and I've made it my career goal to convince people that the eastern red cedar is phenomenal. You know, and everybody says it's a tick magnet, and I don't know if there's any facts behind that. I think cedar trees are no more a tick magnet than any other tree, shrub, or flower that you can find, but it's pretty impressive. You know, people don't appreciate the glades. You know, they're such a unique biome, is what we would call it, an ecological habitat. It's the second most biologically diverse biome in the state, only behind the Appalachian Mountain Range up in East Tennessee. So the plants that grow there are just incredible. You know, eastern red cedars, think back to that freeze we had in 2022. If you remember that flash freeze, it went from 60 degrees down to like zero.
Yeah.
I looked at a lot of the evergreen trees that we plant, and they bit the dust. You know what tree didn't seem to suffer at all?
I'm guessing we can find it at Cedars of Lebanon.
We find lots of it. Eastern red cedar, I mean, they're just so used to that. They have evolved over hundreds of millions of years, well, not that long, but millions of years. Their ancestors have been here for hundreds of millions of years, but they're just used to that type of crazy Tennessee weather.
You know, it's always surprising to me the biodiversity that we have in Tennessee, because you talked about Cedars of Lebanon, but right. if you look at the Duck River, it's one of the most biodiverse rivers in the nation.
It's pretty incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't know that. You know, no. when I teach classes, that's one of the most exciting things for me is I see the light bulb go off for people, and they're like, wow, you know, we think about national parks out west, we think about the Appalachian Mountains, but right here in our backyards, I mean, we're sitting on a natural treasure in so many places.
Yeah, here's one for you. Where is one of the largest rainforests in the world?
Temperate rainforest? I mean, I guess that's up in the mountains, I guess.
Alaska has got...
Well, Alaska, Pacific Northwest, I thought we were looking for Tennessee.
Oh, no,
I
no.
overthought, you know, I'm an overthinker. But yeah, the temperate rainforest of Alaska and Pacific Northwest, and it's one of the true last, you know, temperate rainforest on Earth.
And they have bears to boot, you know.
Lots
can't,
of bears.
Can't beat that.
It seems like we always end up talking about bears.
I know, guys.
When I get on here.
So anyway, moving on past the bears this time.
That's okay. We can talk about them if we need to.
So going back to the rock and you know, growing things in an area where there's tons of rock,
right.
I also found it interesting that I was reading about how, you know, I thought it'd be one day cool to find a piece of land that's got an old rock quarry on it and mm-hmm. maybe build a house near that because it looks so cool with
Absolutely.
That pretty green water. And then I read this article talking about how it's actually dangerous to swim in some of those waters because of the content of different minerals that can, I guess, cause chemical burns almost on your skin.
Now, are they minerals that come out naturally from the ground, or are they the remnants of what industrial action took place there?
It was talking about it being from the actual rock itself.
No kidding.
Yeah.
So maybe when you cut down that deeply and you hit those different layers, yeah, that's probably highly concentrated versus what you're going to see on a surface area or a natural body of water. I could see that.
And I guess when you think about it, you know, getting into those rocks, you know, it being a gravel pit, whatever it is, for years, it causes all that dust. So I guess
right.
that is all that content is
just
in that
settles
water.
Settles into the water. But boy, is it pretty.
It is nice looking.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So maybe just look at it
yes.
over the years.
Yeah.
Don't you dare get in.
Don't jump. Don't do it.
So what else do we have here in Tennessee, Middle Tennessee, that is unique, you know, compared to other areas?
So we have what is called endemic plants, and that's a fancy word for saying we have plants that were found here naturally and nowhere else on the planet, specifically within these cedar glades. And so one prime example that I always use is called the Tennessee coneflower.
Hmm.
And coneflower, echinacea, there are many different species. I'm sure a lot of your listeners have them in their gardens. They're pretty purple flowers, the petals face down. But the Tennessee coneflower is a glade species that naturally evolved here, and it was actually thought to be extinct. You know, they found it in the 1800s. The first botanist, Gattinger, was one of the first botanists to find it, but then they didn't see it anymore. Habitat loss is the number one reason. And then in the 1960s, there was a Vanderbilt biologist, Elsie Quarterman. She was out hiking with a grad student, and they found it.
Huh.
And they thought, my God, they knew exactly what it was, and they're like, it was like seeing a ghost.
And where did they find it?
It was at a small cedar glade right on the edge of kind of that tri-area of Rutherford, Wilson, and Davidson up there near
yeah.
the lake. Can't remember exactly which glade it was, but they found one little population of it that had been untouched for, you know, millennia, and they saved seeds and they were able to reestablish. It was one of the first plants listed on the endangered species list, and I think it was in 2011 it was officially delisted. So it was a true conservation success story. But we have a whole host of plants that are endemics to the glade, meaning that they are found here and nowhere else. Now, you can grow a Tennessee coneflower in Germany and Japan, but it evolved here in Middle Tennessee. So we are very fortunate. We have, I think, 14 unique endemic species that are found within the glades. So, and they're just perfectly adapted. I grow Tennessee coneflower at home and dig them up in the taproot on a plant that's 1 inch long. The taproot can go down a foot. So it's just the ability of those roots to break through limestone and find water is really incredible.
You know, I knew you could find huge diversity at the swimming pool at Cedars of Lebanon, but I had no idea about the plant life there.
Talking about the old pool?
Yeah, the old pool. It was always interesting as a kid to go
right.
there. Man, you saw all walks of life, things that you didn't even know existed. Like,
right.
wow, people talk this way?
Right.
Sorry.
You know, that pool is a butterfly garden now.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And, you know, they call it Cedars of Lebanon, but there's not a single cedar tree at that park. You know, the eastern red cedar that we call cedar is actually a juniper. But the story goes they planted a true cedar, which is not native to this area, where that pool used to be in the middle of that butterfly garden. And guess what happened to it?
Man, what did happen to it?
It died because it was planted in a swimming pool. So the water just sat under the ground. You know, there was no drainage and the roots outgrew it. So the only true cedar in Cedars of Lebanon is toast.
That's funny. So, I had no idea.
But yeah, that swimming pool sits behind the Nature Center now. And that was actually one of the projects that I helped with when I was an agent in Wilson County. It's a beautiful butterfly garden, lots of spring ephemerals. You should check it out. There's on May 2nd and 3rd, there's a festival up there. It's called the Elsie Quarterman Fest, and it's named after the lady that found that Tennessee coneflower. And they have educational events, seminars, hikes, bird walks. So you can go on the Cedars of Lebanon website, and that's May 2nd and 3rd, Elsie Quarterman Festival, and it's a phenomenal event. Take your kids. If you're interested in nature, that would be a great opportunity.
That's cool. I was at Henry Horton, I guess it would have been last summer or so, but I was surprised to see all the cactus there.
The prickly pear cactus.
Yeah.
It's one of the plants with my favorite botanical names, Opuntia humifusa.
That's a mouthful right there.
Right. But yeah, prickly, you know, and people don't think we have cactus here, but we absolutely, that's our native, you know, grows in the glades, grows in rocky areas. Now, there are many prickly pear cactus that grow out west, but this is the unique one that grows here in Tennessee.
Are there any uses for those cactus in Tennessee?
You know, they produce a flower, and that flower is edible. It's kind of like a fruit, basically. And you've probably seen them. They're orangish red in color. And also, you can make a dish out of the cactus. I don't know if you've ever eaten cactus, but it is absolutely delicious.
I have at Mexican restaurants, right, and stuff, and it tastes great.
It's delicious. It's kind of sweet and tangy. So outside of edible uses, I'm sure there are some medicinal uses, but I don't touch that with a 20-foot pole because that'll, you know, you just never know what people will do.
But now you can eat the flower that grows on the Tennessee cactus here.
You can, yeah, absolutely.
I didn't know that.
Now, it has a ton of it has big thorns, which you can see, but then if you look more closely, it has, almost looks like little blisters on it, and those little blisters are full of tiny little hairy thorns, and I'll tell you what, they hurt a lot more than the big ones. So
that would not feel good on your mouth then.
I have several prickly pear cactus in pots at home, and I went to move one and plant it this year, and didn't have the right gloves on, and I think I still have some of those bristles sitting in my fingers right now as we speak. So
how do you go about cutting up that flower that grows on the cactus if you do want to eat it?
You just snip it off the plant, and then you just have to be, and I'm not sure if the flower itself will have a bunch of bristles on it, but you have to be careful when you go to harvest it. If you're having to reach in those plants, they'll get you.
Well, is that the only cactus that we have growing here? So would it be safe to say if we see it on the trail, we just reach down, grab it, pull off the little...
Well, if you see it on the trail, don't touch it, honestly. Yeah, they frown on that. Now, if you have them at home, and if you've got some in your backfield or in a glade, you know, just go for it. But no, if you see them out at a state park or natural area, they would highly discourage you trying to tamper with it just because they're trying to preserve those plants. But yes, if you got them at home,
okay,
have at it.
That'd be like taking rocks from the Grand Canyon, you know. Right. Don't do that.
I may or may not have several on my bookshelf at home.
Gotcha.
Small 10-4. Ones.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of like flying a drone at a state park. Can't do that anymore either,
can't
right?
Do that.
Or is that national parks? Which one is it?
I think it may be both.
It's like a $10,000 fine, I believe.
Yeah, they've really gotten strict on that.
Yeah.
And for good reason. People were highly obnoxious with those drones for a while.
I can imagine that. But if you go to somewhere like that, like the Grand Canyon as an example to relax and just see the natural beauty, having a drone fly over your head,
that's the last thing you want.
It would kill it.
Yeah, those things are annoying.
The helicopter tours are bad enough.
Right.
You know,
got that.
And those are annoying.
They're very much annoying.
So, yeah, I could understand that. So, moving back to Tennessee, what else is happening this time of year? What can we look for?
You know, in terms of just get outside, do some gardening. You know, we're talking about vegetable gardening. Again, people always jump the gun. They want to get their plants out in April. I tell you, don't do it. And the garden centers are really smart. They'll sell you a tomato on April 1st because they know you're going to be back on April 20th to buy a new one, right? So May 1st is my date for planting warm season vegetables here in Tennessee. So that's your tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, squash, and a lot of these plants can be directly seeded into the ground. My rule of thumb on seeding is the bigger the seed, the better it does directly sowing it. So we think about things like beans, right? Squash versus a tomato or a pepper seed, they're tiny. All right, so buy those as transplants. The beans, the squash, cucumbers, you know, zucchini, you can put those directly in the ground and you can start those now in the garden, but you really want to wait till May 1st. I mean, look at the weather last night. I mean, it was down, you know, low 40s, yeah, upper 30s. It doesn't take a freeze to kill those tender vegetable plants. And that's what people need to know. If it's down in the 30s in any way, it'll kill those plants.
Now, most of the tomatoes we see for sale right now, at different grocery stores and stuff, those are shipped in here usually, I guess, from what, Mexico, places like that?
Mexico, California, South America now, Florida will grow a lot. And unfortunately, a lot of those varieties are bred for shipping and not for flavor. Right, they have a thick skin, they're big and juicy, but they're not flavorful. And that's the advantage you have as a home gardener. You can plant some of these tomato varieties that are just so full of flavor. One of my favorites is called Cherokee Purple, and I'm not sure if you've ever seen one or not, but it's purple in color and has stripes on in the fruit itself. And you cut that thing open and it's the darkest, richest tomato you've ever seen. And you put that on a sandwich, BLT in the summertime, the flavor is nothing like anything you would ever buy at the grocery store.
Now, I was going to ask, can we, or are there some grocery stores in the Middle Tennessee area where you can buy tomatoes that are grown at least within a 200-mile radius of here once that right season comes?
This is a great setup for the farmer's market.
Okay, good.
I see what you did there. No, our Rutherford County Farmer's Market is a great spot to get those. You know, you're not going to see a lot of them in the grocery stores. I know there's been a push here in the big grocery stores to buy local, so there's a chance you may find some, but the majority of them will still be your commercial varieties. But if you check out local farmer's markets, and again, I will plug our Rutherford County Market at our Ag Center at Lane Agri Park. It starts May 9th, which is always it's the second Friday of May is when it begins, 7 a.m. to noon, and that'll run every Friday and Tuesday until I think Halloween this year is the last date. And you know, once those tomatoes come into season, you're going to see many different varieties locally grown. They have to be locally grown. You know, we're pretty strict in how we enforce that farmer's market. If we see something that looks suspect, if they've got peaches in May, you know, that we're going to start asking questions, right?
Where do you actually come across that kind of thing?
You know, occasionally, you know, but our growers are phenomenal. You know, they're very trustworthy folks. And I think everybody knows by now, don't try it.
I guess know? I could see somebody who's not a farmer by trade thinking, I'm going to make some extra money here.
Right.
They go out and buy something like that, bring it in, and they never realize, well, you can't grow that this time of year, at least not very well.
It's pretty obvious. But, you know, you see these folks that set up on the side of the road, and hey, more power to them. But, you know, our farmer's market is locally grown. Things are seasonally appropriate. You know, when the sweet corn comes in, my goodness gracious, it is like a flock of sheep coming in that door at all hours of the day. So,
now, I know there was a big push by the state, I guess about what, 2 or 3 years ago, to have these grocery stores buy more fruits and vegetables locally, but
right,
it does seem like that never fully transpired to where they wanted it to be.
Right.
Do we just not have enough farms like used to?
No, it's not a supply issue. I just think it's just the stores themselves not maybe following through on the commitment. Now, I have noticed, though, in the last few years, you will see labels specifically. I see it in the wine aisle a lot. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, that and Georgia products as well.
Georgia products, yeah, but I've noticed it in the wine aisle. I'll have a Tennessee, like at Publix, at my local Publix, they have a Tennessee wine section. So, and I hope in the future it becomes more, at least in the vegetable side, more heavy on the local produced stuff. But you think it takes a lot of effort to go out and procure that, you know, versus they've got suppliers that are, you know, industrial grade suppliers of vegetables. It's probably just the sake of convenience for them.
Yeah. And then I guess cost, because, you know, really a farmer that doesn't have a real big farm, it's going to be hard for them to sell it a low enough price to meet the competition, which may be shipped in from overseas.
Right. But, you know, we have huge vegetable producers in Tennessee. But again, their markets is a little different. But, you know, we do have producers that will ship to big grocery stores, but those are very few and far between.
Have you ever been to those agriculture producers that are maybe in, another state where they're farming? You're talking about thousands and thousands of acres. What's that like?
It's pretty impressive. You know, it's an industrial scale farming operation. I was in North Carolina 2 summers ago. We did a tour there and we went to a vegetable producer and the tomato fields were as far as the eye could see.
Wow.
And you know, it's labor intensive. You think about growing just a few tomatoes in your garden at home, it could be a lot of work. And they had thousands of, I bet they had upwards of 1 million tomato plants.
Man.
Many different varieties that were coming into season at different times throughout the year. And they were supplying Walmart. They were supplying Kroger and Publix. And it was a sight to see, I'll tell you that.
I don't know how they keep an operation that big going, because you look at, you're going to have, first of all, a lot of labor, like you said. But where do you find enough labor in some of these smaller communities that have farms of that size?
It's probably the biggest factor that they deal with. You know, it's hard enough just to grow a plant, right? There's diseases, there's insects, there's weather. It's getting the labor there to help harvest those plants, plant those plants, maintain things. That's probably the biggest limiting factor for a lot of these big operations.
Now, when you talk about a farm that size growing vegetables, does everything or do the majority of things have to be done by hand?
It's still a very hands-on activity. You know, there's no way to mechanically harvest a tomato. You know, if you've seen it probably in the almond fields of California, they have those tree shakers.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's great. But for a tomato plant, you try that and that's it. You're going to shake it to death. So, unfortunately, it is still a very, you know, one person, one plant, picking it and put it in a bushel, you know. So, it's very labor-intensive.
Now, what about peaches? Because for years and years, we always knew peaches. Well, you get the best ones in Georgia, sometimes in Alabama. But is that still the case?
It is, 100%. You know, peaches do not do well here in Tennessee, especially in Middle Tennessee. You get up into some of the higher elevations, they can do okay. But they prefer warmer weather, sandy soil. There's nothing that they like about Middle Tennessee. And this is what I always tell people when they call me and say they want to do an orchard. I say, how many orchards do you see in Rutherford County? I know of maybe two or three at the most.
Yeah.
You know, they're just not something that is fruit trees on a scale of 1 to 10, there are 12 in the difficulty rating. You know, diseases, insects, and a lot of people don't want to spray, and myself included. I don't own a fruit tree. You know, I let Publix do my fruit tree growing for me. So fruit trees, yeah, peaches, it's still a Georgia, it's an Alabama thing.
Hey, I had somebody or ran across someone who listed a home for sale and they had like 30, 40 acres with it. But it talked about how in their ad talked about how they had like 120 fruit trees at their property. And I'm thinking that would be a lot to maintain, first of all. But 100%. Then the insect problem that comes with that, what are we looking at?
You know, it depends on the fruit, but you can guarantee that if there's an insect around, it's going to want to. And there are specific insects that will attack a peach tree, for example. There's a peach tree borer. And as the name implies, it lays eggs in the trunk, and those larval stages, like a big white grub worm, it'll burrow into the trunk, it'll kill a tree. There's other insects that will attack the fruit. And it's not even just the insects, it's the disease pressure.
Yeah.
You know, it's hot and humid here, and hot and humid weather spurns diseases. So unless you're willing to spray, unfortunately, it's just not going to be viable.
Yeah, that is not the kind of hobby I'd want to take on with buying a new house, you know?
Oh, no, absolutely not. You think about the pruning. You think about all the maintenance that goes into that, weed control. I mean, it is a tremendous amount of work for sure.
What about things like grapes? Because like you mentioned, you know, you do see more wine coming from Tennessee now, but growing things like grapes, is that a big pain?
You know, grapes are probably on the labor side less intensive than maybe fruit trees. Now, you do have to have a trellis. You do have to prune them. You do have to harvest. But, you know, some grape varieties here do much better than, like, say, your traditional fruit tree. You know, we have a vineyard there at the office. We have a grape called Norton, and it is a good variety for the South. If you've not been to our office, check it out. We have a grape harvest in August. You know, so grapes, on average, are going to be less labor-intensive, and we never spray a thing on our grapes. We never have and never will. I mean, they're pretty much, we just let them grow, and they do their thing.
But now there are some years that you don't get those grapes like you aim to get, right?
Last year was that year.
That's
the first time ever. Yeah, we lost our crop completely. I checked it on a Friday afternoon in August. We were about, maybe a couple weeks away from our grape harvest day. Went out there on a Tuesday. And mind you, when I checked them Friday, there was just beautiful grape clusters as far as you could see. I went out there Tuesday, and every single cluster, for the most part, had shriveled up and fallen off. And it was just those last couple of weeks of August where it got so oppressively hot. We hadn't had rain for weeks. And, you know, the plants are in a survival mode at that point. And they just made a decision, hey, we're going to survive. And it takes a lot of water, a lot of energy to keep that crop up. And for the first time since we planted that vineyard 20 plus years, we lost our entire crop.
Is that why places like Napa Valley in California and places, you know, different cities and our towns in Italy, why they do so well with grapes? Because they have more consistent, I guess, weather and temperatures?
Weather, it's just the perfect environment. You know, that slope catches that sea rain, but it's just dry enough that it causes, you know, the sugar content in those grapes to actually go through the roof. So, you know, we have none of those things here.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
so it is a challenge, you know. But the variety that we grow is Norton. Another good one is Chardonnay. And there are several. And I would encourage you to check out a website, uthort.com. That's UT as in University of Tennessee, H-O-R-T, like horticulture.com. And on that homepage, there's a fruit and vegetable link. And we have a grape page there that will give you varieties of grapes and really any fruit or vegetables. It's just a great resource, so people should check that out.
Sounds good. We're going to take a short break, and then we will be right back. Justin Stefanski is in studio with us this morning from the Agriculture Extension Service here in Rutherford County.
Rutherford County's 24th annual Earth Day celebration is Saturday, April 26th, 10 to 2 on the Murfreesboro Square. Middle Tennessee Electric is proud to be the primary sponsor and organizer. Free fun for the whole family, April 26th on the Square. RCEarthDay.com for more info.
Hey, this is Dan with Music World and Drummer's Den. Come in for, you know, guitars, keyboards, drums. We have lessons for anything with strings, mandolin, guitar, bass, you name it. We have lessons for anything with keys, Music World and Drummer's Den, and a professional drum teacher as well. So if you need to learn to play something, we have you covered. Come on in, buy you an instrument, start learning today at Music World and Drummer's Den, 2762 South Church Street, right across from the golf course.
Friends? Yes. The financial partners whom you've built a relationship with at Old National Bank are still at the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard location, right here in the borough. And so are the warm, homemade cookies.
Cookies are ready, dear.
Like Grandma used to make. If you need online and mobile banking, Murfreesboro's Old National Bank does that too. You and Old National Bank, better together.
Old National Bank at 2230 Dr. MLK Jr. Boulevard. Old National Bank, member FDIC.
The Action Line on FM 101.9 and AM 1450 Murfreesboro, FM 100.5 Smyrna. Listen and watch at WGNSradio.com.
You're tuned to WGNS. Justin Stefanski in studio with us this morning from the Agriculture Extension Service. You guys do a lot there. You got programs, classes, farmers market. What else happens there?
So we've got some really cool events coming up that are in the horticultural realm. So next Saturday, April 26th, there at Lane Agri Park, in the same building where our farmers market is, the community center, we have an event called the Plant Swap. And I think some of your listeners, I'm sure, have came to this in the past. But basically, it's a free to the public event where you bring plants and you get to take home plants. So you can bring up to 10 different plants. Now, you have to bring stuff that you think people would actually want. Don't dig up some random trashy stuff and bring it to us, you know. And we have a list of plants that we won't take if you go onto our website. But it's called a plant swap. You can bring plants. If you've got extra stuff that you don't need, whether it be vegetables, flowers, trees, shrubs, you can dig them up, pot them up, take them to this plant swap, and then you basically get access to everybody else's plants that they bring, and you can trade out. Basically like a trade-in, trade-out type deal.
That's cool.
From 9 to 11, free of charge. It'll be a big deal. I encourage you to come early. We typically get, 300-400 people that come to that event, so it's pretty cool. Later on in the summer, June 14th, we have an event we're calling the Garden Extravaganza. And if you've ever been to Lane Agri Park, we have our demonstration gardens. So we have a rain garden, a butterfly garden, a vegetable garden. We have fruit trees and things like that. So we're going to be doing garden tours to begin with. So each of our gardens will be on display. You can ask questions. Our certified master gardeners will be there. And then we will have educational sessions following that. So we'll be talking about pretty much everything that you would want to know about gardening and landscaping here in Middle Tennessee. So that's from 9 to noon, June 14th, free of charge at Lane Agri Park. So that'll be a pretty special day for us.
Have you ever run across any odd stories of the plant swap? Maybe somebody brings an illegal plant to the plant swap?
No.
Or has it happened elsewhere that you know about? I could just see that happening one day.
Not so much from a drug standpoint, let's say, but we do get plants that are brought in, let's say privet, for example. Privet is just, it's great as a hedge plant, but it's highly invasive. You can't even grow it or sell it here in Tennessee. And people every year will bring in these invasive plants. Another one is the honeysuckles. People see honeysuckle, they're like, oh, it's great. Unfortunately, 99% of the honeysuckle you see is from China. Either the vine one, or there's a bush one called Amur bush honeysuckle, and it will pop up like crazy. Anything with a berry, so you think about privet. If you've ever seen that, it'll get those blackberries covered. Same thing with these honeysuckles. Birds eat it, and then what do you think those birds do? They go out into the woods, they go out anywhere, and they perfect little fertilizer package, right?
Yeah.
And they spread it. So we, every year, and this is why we put out a list of plants that, like English ivy, mm-hmm. highly invasive. Don't bring us English ivy. Some of these ground covers, winter creeper, euonymus, vinca. And these are all listed now on the Tennessee invasive plant list. So those things we definitely, if we talk about illegal, that's the closest thing we've seen.
You know what I've been surprised at, and people may not realize this when they first plant it, but there's some forms of mint. If you plant it in your garden or something, next thing you know, it's going to take over everything. And I had no idea.
You could take the word some out.
Yeah.
Because it's all mint. Yeah. It is just aggressive. I like mint in potted containers or raised beds where you just let it go. I planted mint in one of my landscape beds when I first moved into my house 8 years ago. And guess what?
I still have mint.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Even some of the native mints. There's a plant called mountain mint. And it's a great plant, but it's Pycnanthema muticum, blunt mountain mint. That'll be on the pop quiz here that I'm going to give. Pycnanthema muticum. But no, and it's a native plant. It's phenomenal. It smells great. But even that mint, our native mints will spread. So, yeah, mints are very aggressive in their growth habit.
And there's only so much mint you can actually digest.
You can't
take it all in.
There's only so much you can do, right?
Yeah. It, supposedly, it's good for a sour stomach.
Really?
Yeah. I've not tried it, but supposedly it does help if your stomach hurts.
I need to go out there and graze on my mint then this summer and try it out.
Maybe
I'll bring you a full report next time.
Next time you have a stomachache, go out there, go
forget
at it.
Forget the Pepto, we're going for the mint.
That's right. They got mint-flavored Pepto now. I wonder if it includes real mint.
I'm sure it does.
Probably. So what else can we look forward to at the Agriculture Extension Service other than the classes, the farmer's market coming up? What else can we see?
Well, I encourage folks to go on our website, rutherford.tennessee.edu, and on that website, we have a newsletter sign up, and that newsletter goes out once a month. It's an email newsletter. And of course, we have 4-H programming, which is the youth programs. We have a junior gardener camp that's coming up June 13th and 14th. It's ages 4th through 6th grade. If you go on that website, you can sign up. And this is hosted by the Master Gardeners. It's garden-related activities, and it's phenomenal. You know, those kids get to experience and get exposed to outside activities. They get to go through the farmer's market. But also, there's a lot of family consumer science events. So, you know, our agents in our office, again, they are in different program areas, but there's always something going on. So I encourage folks to go on our website, rutherford.tennessee.edu. Up in the top right, there's a link called newsletter. They can sign up. It's a once a month email newsletter. We don't spam you at all, and it's a full listing of all of our events and sign up forms and things like that. So that's a great resource for folks.
Now, do y'all get information sent to you from, like, let's say the TWRA or anything like that? Because I saw a release, I think it was fairly recently, about an invasive fish they found to be living here on top of, what was that, carp that people started seeing a lot of?
The Asian carp,
I think. Well, there was another one that they just noticed is in some of the area lakes. And I'm curious, do y'all get notices on that?
Sometimes. You know, a lot of times we'll go to in-service trainings as agents, and they'll have officials from TWRA. That typically, they won't send us things directly. But as agents, we try to stay in the know. We try to have a good pulse as to what's going on. I'm not familiar with this new fish, though.
I need to look it up.
Was it another carp species?
I think it was, but I don't remember it because I didn't read it all. I just read the headline.
I tell you what, these invasive species are probably one of the biggest threats we have to our local ecology.
But people bring them here, right?
They bring them here, unfortunately. And, of course, our weather's changed, so a lot of these animals that were, we've talked about this before, warmer weather has brought up different animals. But the plants, a lot of the plants that we see that are invasive were brought here because they were either pretty for garden usage or they grew. Think about kudzu.
Yeah.
The vine that ate the salad.
That's not from here?
It's not from here. Oh. No, it's an Asian plant. And it was brought in during the 30s to, mitigate erosion along the roads. It was brought in by a federal agency.
Wow.
And then it, of course, if you've ever seen kudzu, it just literally, they call it the vine that ate the South. So
it's bad. You see it a lot driving towards Kentucky, or you used to see it a lot driving towards Kentucky.
During those road cuts, back in the 30s during the, the workers, whatever they called that movement, right, when they built all the roads and highways. And
right after the Depression or something?
Or during it. Yeah, I can't remember. But anyways, they used it. But a lot of these invasive plants, they were used in gardens. And unfortunately, a lot of them we call it escaping cultivation. Think about English ivy. It's a great ground cover, but we see it out in the woods now, where there's another one, Heavenly Bamboo Nandina, gets a beautiful cluster of red berries. And typically anything with a colorful berry, you can almost guarantee that birds are going to eat it. And they don't stay in your yard, do they? They fly out to the woods.
That's right.
And they deposit those seeds in the woods. And unfortunately, these invasives, because they're so aggressive and because there's no natural predators, they didn't evolve here. So there's no check and balance. And they can just dominate and overpower any of our native species. And they just go crazy.
I don't see how some people get certain plants past customs these days, but they do, don't they?
And sometimes they come here by accident. You think about shipping crates. You know, yeah. Some of the bugs, like emerald ash borer, this is an invasive insect that is just decimating ash trees. They think it was brought here from China in a shipping crate. You know, those borers, they borrow in the native ash trees of China. They cut that wood down and there were still viable bugs in that shipping crate and it came here. And of course, our ash trees didn't evolve with it. And I bet there's many of your listeners right now that have had an ash tree that has been cut down in the last few years as a result of this incredibly invasive insect.
You know, it's wild how some of these species grow so fast and literally take over. It makes you wonder if it's this bad or it's gotten this bad here with certain species. How in the world is it? Yeah, I mean, what's it like in these other countries? Has it literally taken over the country?
Well, not necessarily, because you think about, like, let's use just emerald ash borer, for example. You know, it has natural biological controls that control it, right? And some of the invasive plants that come from Southeast Asia, it's just like plants in our gardens here. Now, there are plants from the U.S. and animals, I think raccoons, have actually become invasive in parts of Europe, you know, England and Germany. Because there's no natural control from a predation standpoint, right? They don't have the bobcats and the coyotes and things like that. So, but the plants that are here that are invasive in their natural setting, in their natural countries, they're just another plant that's in perfect unison with the other ecology there.
Yeah. I never thought about it like that. Right. Makes sense, though.
Right.
So, at closing this morning, if anybody would like to learn more, if they want to have a soil sample done, what are the steps they need to take and where do they go?
Soil sampling can be done. You basically want to take 12 to 15 little plugs out of your either a garden or a lawn. You want to go down about 2 to 3 inches. You want to mix those together and you want to pull out sticks or stones. We just need soil. Let it air dry naturally. Don't put it in the microwave or oven. You'd be shocked how many people try to do that.
Really?
Yeah. They bake it. And once you bake it, that's it. We can't use that sample. Bring it to our office, 315 John Rice Boulevard. We pack it up in a nice little box. $20 later, you'll get a sample report, and you can cater it to what you're growing. So if you want to get it tested specifically for a lawn or trees or shrubs or a vegetable garden, we can do that with those soil samples.
Sounds good. Again, Justin Stefanski with the Agriculture Extension Service on John R. Rice Boulevard here in Murfreesboro. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure.
Holden Hardware now has an e-commerce site. Go to doitbest.com/Holden-hardware and shop all the items in our warehouse. You can have them shipped directly to you, or most items can be shipped for free to Holden Hardware for pickup. Shop with us in person or go online to doitbest.com/Holden-hardware.
One more time.
doitbest.com/Holden-hardware.
This is Peter Demas, and our family is inviting your family to come eat with us at Demas's restaurant. Right now, there's this big talk of tariffs. So we start looking at where do all of our suppliers get their product from. Even though we're buying it from, and it looks like it's from an American company, but they're getting it from China. What we're trying to do is we're trying to give people the value. When the prices do go up, we have at least a cushion to work off of. Come eat with us at Demas's restaurant on Northwest Broad Street.
Hi, this is Tina Fox at the Rutherford Farmers Co-op. Come see us for all your lawn and garden needs. Also, if you're looking for that great gift idea, please come see us. If you're looking for that perfect outfit or a wedding gift or baby gift, come see us at the Rutherford Farmers Co-op. And if you haven't heard, we also carry the rain chains. If you're looking for something to replace your old gutter or put somewhere where you can't put a gutter, come see us at the Co-op Farm and Home Center, Middle Tennessee Boulevard, just off of South Church.